This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's a quick 1-2 punch this week. Later, we'll hear from the one and only Albert Bates on the wonder of biochar and how it might save the world's climate. But first, some scientists and authorities, like the International Energy Agency, warn humanity is headed for a world 3.5 degrees C hotter in as little, perhaps, as 25 years. Perhaps you think we'll just turn up the air conditioner, but much of the world's work is done outside. Can humans cope with those kind of temperatures? Here to help us is Dr. Elizabeth Hanna. She's a nurse with a doctorate and national convener of the Climate Change Adaptation Research Network for Human Health at Australian National University. We've reached Dr. Hanna in Warsaw at the COP19 Climate Talks. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
And hello to your listeners.
I appreciate your taking the time to talk with us amid what must be very intense climate talks in Warsaw. What was it like being there?
I can tell you, it's really hectic. I think the numbers are something like 8,000, and of course the meetings go all through the night. It's a wonderful experience, and there's a lot of tensions because obviously people are wanting a lot more than what some of the partners are willing to commit to.
Liz, let's get to your specialty, the capacity of the human body to cope with climate change. What are the challenges that we will face?
If we continue up to, that 3.5 and some say 4 and indeed 6 degrees, the essential thing is this is ultimately, it's not compatible with human existence. That's the raw and the ugly truth of it. And that's why we really do need to do something about it. And of course, the pathway to that is it's not all going to be hunky-dory and really nice until one day it's not pleasant. It'll be this gradual increasing change, such as we're already noticing. And if you notice the heat waves that are happening all over the world, the floods, the droughts, the typhoons such as Haiyan, this is happening when it's not even 1 degree warmer. I shudder to think what 2 degrees, the guardrail that we're all trying to stay below, even that is going to cause so much more human misery. So, I mean, the major health impacts, it depends really on where you are. The countries that are vulnerable to these typhoons, they're obviously going to have more of those, such as the Philippines. It's very difficult for the climate scientists to attribute any specific particular event to, this one was climate change. But that's in many respects the wrong question. The trend is on the basis of probability, the fact that we're getting so many more and they're so more intense, that's the real question, and the answer to that is a definite yes. And so the people that are suffering the typhoons, Australia's had, intense droughts, intense heat waves and intense floods, and we're not alone. Europe lost, some reports, including the World Health Organization, suggest that 70,000 people died in the heat waves in Europe. And that's temperatures that are nothing like what Australia hits, but the whole thing is relative. Russia, the Moscow heat wave, A, caused lots of fires, B, caused a lot of crop failures. And one of the sort of less direct impacts are when you have major heat waves and droughts and indeed floods. If you wipe out the crops from one of the major food exporting countries, such as what Russia did at that time, and you can sort of understand, if they lose a good deal of their stable crops, they stopped exporting. When a major food exporter stops exporting, the food prices globally escalate, and that carries over to the other basic foodstuffs. And if you think about the people who are largely dependent, particularly the sub-Saharan African people, if they're already spending 80% of their weekly income on food, their capacity to absorb doubling or an extra 50% of the food prices is not something that they can't really do. So there are the complex ramifications in terms of food shortages and food insecurity, water problems. Obviously, people are going to suffer if they're caught in the floods, the risk of cholera and the waterborne diseases. General heat causes a lot of extra foodborne diseases. And, of course, when you change the climate and you get, the malaria, which once upon a time was restricted to a certain area because it doesn't like getting below 15 degrees, when you find with warming in many countries, the range of the mosquito is extending into what we call virgin populations. And so the people who are not equipped to cope physiologically and indeed in their cultural practices, and indeed the medicos who, they're not used to looking for, malaria, Dengue is another one that's extending. And, of course, my own work is heat. That's a real killer for places like Australia. But, of course, as we've seen, I mean, cooler places like Russia and Europe have had massive death rates because of heat.
Well, let's talk about the human body. What are the upper tolerances that we can handle?
It's interesting. When you think about it, we need to keep our core temperature within a really very narrow range, between about 36 and 37. And when the outside air temperature is higher than that, then it's very difficult for us to lose heat. And we generate heat just through our metabolism. But it's interesting that sort of 80% of the energy produced by working muscles is heat, so that has to be dissipated. And when you have temperatures outside the human body, the ambient temperature, that's getting close to that, then it's really difficult to shed that extra heat. And so if we can't shed it, we store it. And as you know, when your temperature gets to about 38, you start feeling pretty ordinary. 38.5, you're certainly reaching for the Panadol. And in hospitals where I started my working career, we'd be in intensive care, we'd be certainly giving not only aspirins but antibiotics. You're really quite ill when your core temperature is about 39. And, of course, people die when their core temperature reaches 40, 41. We really can't tolerate that. And what's really significant is that it depends on what your normal range is, your normal natural environment, but there is an upper limit. And if you think about when people like to put the air conditioning on or the heating, they tend to set it at around about 22 degrees, which is 15 degrees cooler than our body temperature. And, of course, this basically means that when the outside temperature is much hotter than our body temperature, then this is when it becomes problematic.
Liz Hanna, in the business press, major corporations and economists worry a lot about worker productivity. They tell us productive workforce, that's the key, yet they don't seem to worry about global warming at the same time. Or are they missing something?
Absolutely. And this is the focus of a good deal of the work that I'm doing at the moment. That's actually looking to see what is the human thermal tolerance. I mean, obviously I'm Australian and my work is focused on Australia at the moment, but it's part of a global project. But at the moment, what we find is that the places in the southern part of the continent, they actually think are hot days around about, you know, 25, 27 degrees. They can keep working, but they feel it hot. At the top end of Australia, where it's in the tropical region, we've got Darwin that's sort of 32, 33 degrees. It used to be 32, 33 every day. Well, now it's sort of 35 every day. But the humidity is extreme. And every time when we go and visit those places, the plane opens and we just get knocked by this wall of sort of oppressive heat and humidity, and we find it very difficult to move. A lot of people move up to Darwin and you know, the other tropical areas around Australia, as they would do to the hot areas and other places. Those that can't cope with it pack up and go home back to a cooler place. And we find a lot of, you know, if people are sent to work, if their families can't cope, they move back. What's really becoming alarming is that a lot of these areas are going to become even more intensively hot, and that's going to probably make even a smaller proportion of the population be able to cope. And, of course, all these places involve, you know, people that work in construction, people that climb up your telephone poles to fix those when we're in the power blackout, the people that change your car tyres, the district nurses who go out and visit people. And, of course, in the heat waves in Australia, you could imagine the district nurses are really not very inclined to call in sick saying, oh, no, look, it's too hot, because they know that if they don't go out and visit the people in their care, they're going to die. And so the people that sort of push themselves beyond their thermal tolerance tend to fall into a few categories. There are those with the awful employers that force them. Hopefully in a civil society, we don't have ugly, horrible employers much anymore, but of course some will still exist. Or people that are in fear of losing their jobs. It's also people that feel responsible. You know, they're responsible like the essential services, the police, the ambulance, the district nurses, the SES who come and save you or fix your telephone poles, or the military, of course, have been another category. In fact, a lot of the early work on heat tolerance actually came out of the military, as they were finding that the soldiers were dying in training, and it was pretty difficult for the military to send letters home to their mothers saying, look, sorry, your son died. He didn't see combat. We just pushed him too hard. And so there is an upper thermal tolerance. We don't actually know what that is. There has been virtually no work done on this as far as the general working population around Australia, you know, in the world. And that's what my project's actually trying to do, and find out what strategies work, what don't work, because we're certainly going to have to change our way of thinking. Because the bottom line is that when you've got a hot place like Australia, and this is the same for all those Asian countries, the economy cannot tolerate us thinking, okay, well, it's summer, we have to down tools and industry just to shut up shop. Conversely, we can't keep pushing people until they die. And of course, a lot of those jobs just can't be done in air-conditioned comfort. But we really need to sort out how we're going to cope with this. And the bottom line is that if the planet keeps warming, it's going to be a real problem.
It's going to affect our whole economy. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Liz Hanna from Australian National University. She is a specialist in how the human body handles extreme heat. And as you point out, there have been studies done for the military and also for athletes, how they're going to cope, say, in the Summer Olympics. But it seems like we haven't done much about the miners, the farmers, or the people who keep our whole system going. What does need to be done?
I think we need a new mindset. There are certain tasks that we can leave till the cooler part of the day and do in, you know, the cooler times of the year. But there are certain tasks that really do need to be done. In some industries, that might mean having cool rooms where people can actually go out, do their job and come in and cool down. Because certainly, I mean, even in Australia, some jobs are done at night. As it is, a lot of the road making in summer is done at night. Picking the grapes is done at night, although I'm told that that's actually largely because it's better for the grapes rather than for the people. It's a sad reflection. I understand that in countries such as yours where you have blizzards and snow, that there's tolerance when there are blizzards and snow and people can't move. Even in places like Australia, there isn't. We don't have formalised tolerances for houses taking too long to be built or people not coming into work in those jobs that have some flexibility because of the heat. We're not taught in the health curricula about heat because it seemed to be such a rare thing and it just wasn't on the radar. And of course now it's something that we're just going to have to educate ourselves and actually permeate it through, you know, through society, making people being aware of looking out for each other, looking out for their children, looking out for their elderly, and being tolerant on each other in terms of the workplace and expectations.
Well, Dr. Hanna, I'm assuming some industries and companies will be too slow to make the necessary changes. And will we see more occupational injuries and death due to a hotter climate, I would expect? And if so, what would that look like?
Sadly, yes, that probably is true because in an ideal world, all industries, all companies and everyone would behave perfectly. Although sadly, we realise this isn't always the case. There are some positive movements that we're seeing in Australia now, but of course, interestingly, they're the ones that are signing into being participants in my project. They're the ones that actually recognise that heat is an issue. Those that say, oh, no, not interested, they're the ones that we really do need to get to, but of course, you can't participate in people who won't engage with you, and you wonder what their work practices are.
What does it look like at the medical level when these things happen?
There's a few things. At the light level, dehydration is a really, really key part of it because of the extra strain it puts on the body. When people get to a certain level of dehydration, and it's really at the very early stages, your cognitive function starts to diminish. This becomes really problematic if people are in charge of heavy equipment or making decisions. And this is only when you're, you know, only a few percent, very small percent of dehydration. There's other risks such as even just sweaty hands and people's, you know, slipping and dropping things. And so the occupational health and safety is an issue in that respect. And that can come at even sort of the early stages. In the hot places such as one of our tropical towns, Darwin, 80% of the violence happens during certain months of the year, which is called the build-up, and that's when it gets really hot and the humidity starts to kick in. And this is the male-to-male violence and the domestic violence. That's huge. It's because it's become very oppressive. So there's mental health issues as well in terms of, you know, violence and irritation, aggression. And physiologically, it's interesting the pathway that happens. It's, if you're fully acclimatized, obviously what our body tries to do is to kick in the thermoregulatory system, and that's when it's hot, it's largely through perspiration. So we start sweating a lot. Sweating adds to the dehydration. Given, and the other thing is, when it's hot, we try to shed heat by opening up all the skin blood vessels, which means that the volume of your blood vessels opens up a lot. So A, you're losing fluid by sweating. B, it's opening up the vessels, which, and if you increase the volume of the circulatory system, the pressure goes down, which means you really do need to drink to fill up that that volume. If you're not drinking enough, that means that your heart is working really, really hard to keep perfusing that. And if you're working or exercising or doing things, it's also trying to send a lot of blood to your muscles. At the same time, it's trying to dissipate heat by sending a lot of blood to the skin. And so it's working, that's what, it goes very, very hard, and it works very fast and very strong beats. And that's why the people that have compromised cardiac performance, they're the ones that are likely to suffer early. And of course, just in heat waves, even if people aren't actually working, it's one of the reasons why you find the elderly who are the first to succumb. But of course, that can happen to anyone who's pushing themselves too hard. And people tend not to recognise it. In a place like Australia, some of the responses we're getting from people we interview is that, look, it's just summer, get over it. You know, don't be wussy. You know, you can keep going, just, you know, soldier on. And I think this is where we need to change our mindset, in the fact that recognise that heat can kill and is killing people. In fact, it's already killing more people than the road death. And heat has killed more people in Australia than any other natural hazard ever. And this is repeated annually. And this is even prior to the increased deaths that we're having with all these extra fires and, you know, these extreme heat waves. Because, I mean, we got up to, you know, a city in Melbourne, you know, 4 million people. On the outskirts of Melbourne was just under 50 degrees, and that's 50. A city can't cope with temperatures like that. The train lines buckled, so we had to stop the trains and put people out on buses and walking in extreme heat. It's just not tenable.
And that's where we're going if we keep using fossil fuels. The United Nations has finally admitted air pollution kills people. Have you looked into the links between climate heating and air pollution and our health?
Personally, I haven't, but in the network that the research network that I was convening, a lot of my research partners are. There's many pathways that that this actually works. Part of it, of course, is the people that are living near the coal stations or where the coal trains are rumbling past their doors and their kindergartens. There's also the burning of fossil fuels and ground-level ozone. The particulates in the air, of course, which come from any of the car engines, plus certainly some of the diesel and others, and they're particularly irritating to the vessels, both in the lungs and in the heart. And so you actually find that there's, even in a single city, there's a ratio of admissions to hospital, and that's closer around the major arterial systems. So it acts in many ways to exacerbate the pre-existing and indeed to precipitate people having respiratory and cardiac issues where prior they didn't know they had any issues. Yeah, so air pollution is a major issue. So there are so many arguments for getting off fossil fuels. There isn't any argument that we can think of that runs counter to this argument that's good for the planet and it's good for human health.
Well, that's a good point to wrap up. Our guest has been Dr. Elizabeth Hanna, an expert in global heating and human health at the Australian National University. Thank you so much, Dr. Hanna.
Absolute pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
From America's original Back to the Land, the Farm in Tennessee, this is alternative guru Albert Bates. His keynote speech at the Bioneer Chicago Great Lakes 2013 conference was recorded for Radio EcoShock by Kelly Pierce of the Chicago Independent Media Center. Here's Albert.
I'm a country boy at heart now, and I'm a long ways from home. And my friend Nicole Foss, with whom I teach permaculture courses, says, all political systems exist to concentrate wealth from the periphery to the center. Doesn't matter whether you're talking about capitalism or socialism or something else. Capitalism is simply more effective at it. capitalism, like every other industrial economic model, is essentially a Ponzi scheme. We've had the period of boom, and now we're looking at a period of bust. We created the excess claims to underlying real wealth, as she's fond of saying. The cake is baked, and there's no avoiding its consequences. My objective of this talk is to show you a different kind of vision, one based on steady state economics that can lead us through the present turmoil and get us to a much better world for our children and our grandchildren. Now, Pam alluded to the fact that I had been an attorney for a number of years, and many years ago, I was an environmental pit bull fighting bad guys. Eventually, I got high blood pressure and decided being a type A individual is probably not suited to my marriage and various other things. So I retired from that. But back when I was busy taking on the nuclear industry and the chemical industry, I was confronted by a problem a little closer to home. That was the plants near us that were making agrochemicals, pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers. And they were injecting their toxic wastes into the aquifer that goes below our farm. So I looked at that, and as a lawyer, I went and read the Safe Drinking Water Act, and I said, you know, it doesn't say anything here about toxic pollutants. It says no contaminant into a safe drinking water source. And so what's going on here? And I went to protest, and we organized a group, and we filed a lawsuit, and the EPA was actually backing the chemical companies because they felt the deep well injection was better than incineration. So they were injecting toxic waste into this aquifer that goes all the way from the mountains in the east to the Gulf of Mexico. And the chemical company's essential argument was, you know, we're dumping it a mile down and nobody's going to go that deep for water. So I had two arguments to make in 1980. And those arguments were that, first, our population's growing and that there will be more need for water in the future. And secondly, climate is changing, and that will also accelerate demands on water. So I was going into a Tennessee court in 1980 trying to persuade the judge that climate change was real. And to do that, I had to troll the various agencies and scientific studies and take subscriptions to various magazines and start talking to experts and trying to line up my ducks to make this proof. And in the process, I did eventually prevail in court. We stopped the industry. We ended deep well injection in Tennessee. And actually, what did it for us was an end run around the whole court process. It was going to elect a new governor for Tennessee. And then we were on this transition team. And one of the first things we did was to work with the Department of Health and Environment to get deep well injection banned in the state of Tennessee, which actually banned fracking until recently, when the oil and gas lobby came in and said, well, we need an exemption for fracking for oil and gas. And, you know, here in Chicago or in Illinois generally, you could probably buy a state legislature. It might cost you, you know, $1 million or $10 million to buy a legislator. In Tennessee, it's cheap. You can get them for $10,000 or $25,000. Heck, if you give them $1 million, they'd come and engage in unnatural sex in your home. But, you know, it's not surprising that you're allowed to frack again now. We're completely controlled by a very strange legislature. Well, anyway, in the process, I scared myself. And Pam mentioned this book I wrote. It was a compilation of all of the data I had gotten. Al Gore wrote the foreword to the book. He had helped provide me a lot of the information. And I discussed the possibility of a runaway greenhouse where 3 degrees would take us to 4 and 4 to 5 and so on. And as we pass through these tipping points, each one would trigger a larger one. And from what we're seeing now from the Calathrate bubbles, we're committed to a significant increase. Those tipping points are being crossed. I scared myself and I stayed scared for 20 years. These are some of the images that I drew for the book. And this was almost 30 years ago now. I talked about methane clathrates in the book, but didn't chart them. Early this year, that data became alarming as well. I had pictures of the flooding and how it would look in Bangladesh and how it would look in Long Island and New Jersey Shore and Florida and other places as storm events came and changed the coastlines. And I talked about all these things, but, you know, you can know about this, and it's a whole nother thing to actually experience it. I parked my Mini Cooper at the Nashville airport in 2010 on my way somewhere, and it was not in a flood zone. But when I came back, it had washed down the river. There hadn't been a river there before. You know, I'm not immune. And it was 10 inches of rain in 48 hours. And we've seen floods in Pakistan and England and Boulder, and hot air holds more water. Ames, Iowa had a 500-year flood in 2010, three times. You know, so knowing what's coming doesn't necessarily make you exempt or even prepare yourself all that much. Cost of preparation for me is really to build a secure eco-village on the highest ridge between Cincinnati and New Orleans and plant food and construct earth-sheltered, tornado-proof houses there. But we're at the center of the storm there. You know, you may not notice these things if you're living in a city, but if you're deeply embedded in the nature, you notice these things. Most farmers get it. And the climate that we have in Middle Tennessee today was not the climate that we had when we started the farm in 1971. That climate is now up somewhere near Lexington, Kentucky. The climate that we have today was down in Neshoba County, Mississippi in 1971. It's been moving about 40 miles per decade. It's now accelerating. It's up to about 70 miles per decade. We know this from changes of when things go into blossom in the spring and when different kinds of migrating insects and birds come. We've changed two agricultural planting zones in 40 years. Ultimately, we will need to find our way to get beyond zero. Carbon neutral will not be good enough. I've been going to UN meetings over the years, and one of the things we see there is these projections. If we wait so long, then we're going to have a steeper decline in emissions in order to stay within 1 degree or 2 degrees of warming. And actually, if you go out past 2030 or thereabouts, you actually have to get into negative emissions. Now, what does that mean? You can't just not emit. You actually have to net sequester. You have to bring more down from the atmosphere and out of the oceans each year than are going there, okay? Well, this is beyond normal scientific disciplines at this point. This is what they're calling in science hyper-wicked problems, because they're cross-cutting and embedded in the culture and the religion and the ways we do things in our society and have for thousands of years. And to become a future society that net sequesters carbon, half of our elected congressmen now say they don't believe in anthropogenic climate change. And they think the United Nations is a one-world conspiracy. Their scientific literacy, as well as those of our children, is declining. So all of this is quite scary, and you would have to say that our chances of getting out of this without going extinct are really pretty slim, which is what I thought. And then I went through this period of deep depression, and I call it my Houston moment, not because of, like, Houston, we have a problem, but because of, I was in Houston, Texas, the moment I had this, which is, we're fracked. And maybe it was already blown before I was born. Maybe this was already set in motion to the point where there was no recovery back then. So when you get to that realization, what can you possibly do? And my sense has been that if there's a little bit of hope, an ember of hope, I'm going to blow on it and try to start a fire. And really, for my own sanity, the only thing I can do is to try to do something. To try to, you know, if I'm in a sinking boat, I'm going to start bailing even if it's hopeless. And then I happened to go to a permaculture conference in Brazil, which gave me some real hope. And for the first time, I saw the Amazonian dark earths, and I started to inquire how they came into being. And that led me to the story of Francisco de Orellana and the world that he saw when he came to the Americas and was the first to travel down the Amazon River was different than portrayed by historians and anthropologists until very recently. It was not a savage world, but one as developed as Europe at that time. So I went to the textbooks. Actually, I was, you know, greatly benefited. The book that Orellana's, his journals of his travels, he had a faithful Dominican scribe named Gaspar de Carvajal. And his journey in 1542 had been daily chronicled, but it was in medieval Spanish. It had never been translated into English. But thanks to Google Books, it was available from the collection at the Library of Sevilla. And thanks to Google Translator, you can actually run it through a Spanish translator and get a reasonable approximation. And if you know a little bit about Spanish, you can translate the medieval Spanish words. Using that, I was able to actually get a picture of what he saw. And it's an interesting story because he saw this world and then he went back to Spain and he told the king and they financed a second voyage. And he traveled up the Amazon this time from the Atlantic instead of coming down from Ecuador. And he was hit by a poison arrow about 2 weeks in and died. And that was the end of that voyage. And no other Europeans arrived for another 50 years. And what happened in that 50 years, you know, Charles Mann describes it as entire cultures hissed away like steam. Because of the first contact, the diseases spread like virus through the American peoples. And they did not have any immunity to the European diseases. And there was something like a 95% kill. This is an area of some dispute among scholars, but in the Amazon basin, it was around 95%, which means, you know, all of art, all of culture, all of literature, all of history, everything that you have in your culture disappears. And tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of people died. Some 250 domesticated species of crops were lost forever. We know this from pollen records. Consensus view was that back in Spain, they said Orellana was a liar, that what he saw was crazy, that his journals were just reports of a madman. And so they were deep six. Then they wound up in the Library of Sevilla where they just sat in cobwebs. Well, one of the things that you started to see was these reports of the Black Earths, that the basis for this rich, deep civilization that had mechanical machinery with moving parts, that had large ships that were docked along long wharf fronts on in front of cities on the riversides, and the cities extended for many kilometers inland, gleaming white in the distance, and wide causeways and things like that that were in his reports. And they all, you know, vanished back into the jungle after people disappeared. And was that the basis for that civilization was its agriculture, was its ability to feed large populations, and they had these rich earths. And as I read it, I began to understand there's two man-made objects that are visible with the unaided eye if you're standing on the moon. One is the Amazon rainforest, and the other is the Sahara Desert. The two worlds collided at the Columbian encounter. European agriculture, which comes from the Fertile Crescent, northern China, northern Africa, is based on extraction. It's based on irrigation and the plow. And everywhere that began, today there are deserts. In the New World, agriculture was based on building soil. And everywhere that the populations were the densest, the soils were the deepest. This was an amazing discovery, and it's only just recently come to light in the last three decades. But it was based on agroforestry, holistic management, pasturage practices, and biochar. I'm going to talk a little bit more about this because we need this, and we need a permaculture army to make the switch, which is what I do. I train up that army. Researchers have uncovered this evidence that supports now this idea that urban societies were based around agriculture. And we know that after the depopulation and large-scale abandonment of the cities of the Americas and their subsequent reforestation, that it sequestered a huge amount of carbon from the atmosphere in a very short amount of time. In decades or centuries, it lowered the temperature of Europe to the point where they had a little ice age, and Louis XIV had to put parquet floors on the palace in Versailles to keep his feet warm, and the Swedes invaded Denmark over the ice, and Hans Brinker won the silver skates on the frozen canals. All of that as a result of this sudden sequestration of massive gigatons and gigatons of carbon from the atmosphere. you know, a similar experience happened when Genghis Khan invaded to the east, actually, or to the west. Actually, it wasn't Khan himself. He divided the Mongol Empire among his four sons. And from 1235 to 1241, they conquered most of Eastern Europe, from the Urals as far east as Vienna, far west as Vienna, and then extending the empire to the gold through east through Siberia. And they exterminated the populations in many places. They were not nice people. And so there was a regrowth of forests similar to what we saw in the 15th and 16th centuries in the Americas. And it absorbed about 700 million tons of carbon from the atmosphere, which equaled the amount of carbon that global society now produces annually from gasoline. So why was the Amazon so fertile? This is, you know, why Henry Ford went and set up Fordlandia to grow rubber there. How did it manage to become so deeply fertile there at the equator, where it had been millions of years since the last glaciation? And the foreign invaders exploited these qualities, but they didn't really explain the phenomena. And it wasn't until a young man named Wim Sombroek, a Dutch soil scientist, arrived in the late 90s, he got there in the 60s as part of a UN exploration, but he didn't really explain it until the 90s. And he did all of these analyses of the soils there, and he saw something in the digs, in the archaeological digs of the soils, that reminded him of something, because Wim Sombroek was born during the Second World War, and he remembered the Hunger Winter of 1945-1946. When the European allies had not yet fully normalized in Europe, and so you had not enough food for the population. And he remembered his father in Holland going out to the garden with the cinders from his fireplace and putting them in the garden to help grow tomatoes and things in the spring. And then he was in these digs looking at pottery shards coming out of the earth, and he noticed charcoal. And he said, aha, this is like the Plaggen soils of Holland. The charcoal was used by the peoples to create fertility in their landscape, in their garden. And that is what we are today calling biochar. We haven't thought about this very much, but, you know, charcoal, what does it really do if you add it to soil? Biochar is actually a word that we're using because charcoal is a misleading term. You know, you can get it in the hardware store, you can get it in the grocery store for your barbecue, but it might have petroleum additives to make it ignite quickly and last a long time. And in fact, that's not what you want to put in your garden. So biochar refers to charcoal that's suitable for putting into a food system. It doesn't have contaminants. And so the proposed definition is a solid carbonaceous material, which is produced by the burning in the absence of oxygen. And what this does is it drives off all of the components other than the carbon. All of the volatile gases go off and get burned. And then what's left behind is hard carbon. And it's actually a crystalline kind of matrix of carbon. It's a very strong bond. It doesn't break down very easily. It doesn't become free carbon that's taken up by the plants. It's more like a soil structure carbon. And if you look at it under a microscope, you see what the value to the garden is, because it's porous. It has this pore structure that's created by the cell structure of the plant, but it's also pitted with the gases as they expand in the fire. So there are pores on the walls of the pores. And if you look down with a good enough microscope, you see pores on the walls of the pores of the walls. It's fractal. It's turtles all the way down. And so there you have, you know, it depends on what kind of plants you started with or what the temperatures were and different kinds of factors, but you get this porous structure. Well, if you're a soil microbe, if you're a bacteria or a fungi or a non-parasitic nematode or a microarthropod, you come into this structure and you see this and say, wow, a condo. I'm going to move my whole family in. And it's got high cation exchange, which essentially means the walls are magnetic for certain kinds of minerals. And so it's like painting the walls with an adhesive paint. And so as the nutrients get brought into this coral reef, they stick and they stay there in that reef. And then the microbes, the bacteria, draw them on demand, and they provide particular nutrients on demand to the roots of the plants through the soil food web. very quickly, as soon as the charcoal hits the ground, it immediately gets populated. And you see the fungi come in. And you see these bacteria start to fill the cavities and bring in their food sources. And the diversity skyrockets through the roof. So immediately what you see is if you have poor soil and you add biochar to it, the plants begin to grow much better. You get much stronger photosynthesis. There's available nutrients on demand. This is actually not entirely new. We had textbooks back in the mid-19th century that said, put charcoal on your tomato plants, put them on your peppers, put them on your turnips, and they'll do wonders. And this was fairly common. And with the advent of the Haber-Bosch process in the 1930s and artificial ammonium fertilizers, suddenly all of this knowledge was no longer needed.
You're listening to Albert Bates on Radio EcoShock.
So two different kinds of carbon, and the kind that normally goes through the carbon cycle is about a 12-year cycle. You know, a plant dies, it decays in the earth, it off-gases to the atmosphere as carbon dioxide or methane, and that travels, you know, through the sky for a while. Maybe some of it gets rained down into the oceans. Some of it gets rained back to the land, and then gets taken up by the plants again and becomes next year's stalks and leaves and so forth. Well, that's the normal labile carbon cycle, typically 10, 12, 15 years. There's another kind of carbon, which is if you char something, then that forms a very hard bond and it doesn't break down for perhaps 1,000 years. It stays in the soil, not as food, but as structure. And it's an open structure. You just saw the porous part of it, the pores. And so now you've got the potential to hold water like a sponge or air, and aerobic bacteria love that. So you have the carbon capacity to begin to do this structural effect. And if you look at carbon reservoirs, where they exist in the earth and in the water and in the oceans and so forth, let's take a small exercise. It's an exercise in holistic thinking. So if you're going to think like a piece of Gaia's new neocortex, you have four organs that you're balancing for carbon, and nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium and other elements too. And you have to keep them all in balance. But let's start with carbon now. Fossil fuel combustion will release 30 billion tons of carbon dioxide this year. If that was phased out over 40 years on a straight line basis, a total of 580 billion tons would still be released before emissions stop completely by 2050, say. Deforestation is releasing 7 billion tons a year. If it proves possible to stop that in 10 years, it will add 35 billion tons to the atmosphere by 2020. If we ignore other releases from the way we use and abuse the land, including methane from cattle, and we keep those and we keep the rice we grow, and the nitrous oxide from fertilizers we apply, we're looking at adding another 615 billion tons of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere by mid-century, even with an incredibly aggressive emissions mitigation program. Now, that's 615 billion tons of carbon dioxide that'll have to be removed together with the excess carbon dioxide that's already up there. So suppose we take 350 parts per million as our initial target, as James Hansen and others suggest. At present, 2.9 trillion tons of carbon dioxide. So reducing its concentration from 400 to 350 means we have to take about 300 billion tons out. Okay, so these are our best options. And we can find that we can get our 8 to 10 gigatons of carbon from these wedges. This is how much per year you can get out using carbon farming, like Vandana Shiva suggests, emissions reductions like the UN's working so hard to accomplish, afforestation, reforestation, and biochar. And afforestation, reforestation is another big one. So plant trees, grow fruit trees, grow nut trees, change the city trees to things that produce food, that kind of thing. These are our best options, and we can find that we can get it, but we have to work in coordinated ways. And can we be sure that they will work? One of the things I learned in the process of experimenting and taking what I learned in Brazil back to the farm in Tennessee and starting to make biochar and put it in my garden was that there's an important piece that they don't often tell you about, which is that actually, if you just put charcoal in your garden for the first year or two, the plants will probably do worse. Why is that? Well, it's because they need to fill up all those rooms in the condo with the bacteria and the nematodes and all their nutrients. So they're stealing all of that from the garden to fill up the soil reef. And what you need to do first, actually, is put the charcoal in your compost pile.
And then it fills up with everything that's needed for the garden. And then you put it in the garden and suddenly you get this beautiful growth. Everything does wonderfully. So we started doing this at the farm, and then we got into compost teas. Now, compost teas is a whole nother step. So instead of just the compost, which is very rich in nutrients, we want to get the biology amped up. So we want to get those, all of those bacteria and fungi, all the aerobic kinds that are really good for gardens, all going really strong before we get them into the garden. And so to do that, we brew them in aerobic water at a particular warm temperature, and we get them going really strong over about a 24-hour period, and then we put that in the garden. This is the agriculture of the Americas. This is the agriculture that we give to the world. It was a whole systems in which the nutrients were returned to the places where they originated rather than exported upriver or across an ocean or by rail or by large semi-tractor trailers to some distant city and then wind up in the sewage treatment plant, which goes into the river. No, it's going back to the fields. It's actually recycling back. And so the takeaways essentially for me are that you have this whole soil food web that is the basis of our life. And we need to think about this in biological terms, not chemical terms. We've been reducing everything, you know, Liebig's law of moving everything to the, you know, what's the critical elements that we need to get into our diet or into our food supply or so forth. No, what we really need to think about are what are the critical biology factors that make for resilience in the ecosystems. Okay, then the next question is, how do we get buy-in? How do we get people to actually go for this system over the existing systems that are so heavily sponsored by industry and governments? And my concept is to look at this, what I'm calling cool food, and hoping to create as a cool food movement. And examples, this is the largest CSA in Europe, the largest subscription agriculture system. 25,000 subscribers buy from this one farmer. And he has a biochar-producing heating kiln, which also has a Stirling engine on it. So it produces 5 kilowatts or 25 kilowatts of power. And then it produces all of the electricity needed for the fans and the lights and everything else in his farm, pumps and whatnot. And then he also produces heat that keeps his greenhouses going all through the winter. So he has a four-season harvest for all of his subscribers. And he's making biochar. So the biochar then goes back into his plants, which then become nutrient dense. If you look at problems that they've been having in Japan as the population ages there, the Satoyama, which literally means second nature, was the area outside of the farms where farmers would go to get bamboo or hunt or various other things. And now there's not enough young farmers. They've all gone off to the city. And the old farmers don't use the Satoyama as much. And so it's become overgrown and the wild boars come and they ravage the rice paddies. And so a group of farmers banded together in the Hozu Farmer Co-op, and they created a biochar-making system where they would harvest the bamboo out of the Satoyama to keep the wild boars from growing too much. Then they would turn that into biochar, put it into their fields, and then they started branding the food. So they were growing cabbages made in biochar, and they knew that they were net sequestering carbon in the process. So they called it cool food, and they sold mixes of cool slaw in the stores at a slight premium, and they sold out. And so they surveyed the buyers of these things, and they found that the consumers were largely families that had children, and the children were telling their parents, buy this, it will help save the planet. And in fact, they started marketing then to children by having cartoons and comic books and things talking about Mr. Biochar and the things that he does in the garden and how you can carbon sequester while having higher nutrient density in your food. So this is a whole systems model for industry to be able to look at cool products, right? So Craig Sams, who founded Green and Blacks, is now in Belize. He's working with the Toledo Cacao Growers Organic Association that's making organic chocolate. And they're taking the cacao pods, which is a waste product of the industry, putting it into kilns and making biochar that goes back into the cacao orchards to make the cacao orchards more resilient and nutrient dense. And then they're making charcoalite. Cesar Velez in Mexico doing the same thing with making agave, and he's producing what in the future may be called charquila. So that's cool foods. Now also think about cool fuels. We have the possibility here. This is the village. It's an eco village in Ireland, and they have district heating, Ireland's first eco village, 30 homes in a village and 20 more in the adjoining older village. And what they want to do is replace Polish coal, which is the traditional Irish way of heating their homes, and endangered peat with a facility that takes 40 acres of pelletized biomass annually. Well, if they put in and switch over their boilers, and they're working with the European Commission to get a grant to do this, and make biochar using a pyrolytic instead of an oxidizing burn, they can actually reduce their demand for pellets by 30%. And so they use less acreage every year to make the biomass. And they can actually work it from waste crops, waste to stubble from corn and wheat and so forth, and sawdust from sawmills and other kinds of waste products that, if left on their own, would become carbon dioxide in the atmosphere or methane. So they're using the biochar that they would produce from, and they're already producing biochar, from home and community gardens throughout County Tipperary. And they contract with local farmers and they return a lot of the biochar to them. So here's a way that you can actually do this, making your own biochar stove that you can put into your wood stove. If you have a wood burner, a wood heater, you just have to make a cylinder, puncture some holes so that the gases can escape, have a tight fitting lid. I put a screw on one end, and then I have an eyelet on the other end so I can lift it out of the fire when it's hot. I fill it with bamboo. I throw it in my wood stove. I make biochar, and then it gases. And you see the little blue jets coming out of the side of the stove. And then you know that it's making gas, and it's also producing charcoal. And then as soon as the blue gas stops, then I know that it's done. I take it out. I cool it off, throw it out in the snow, bring it back in, unscrew it, put in more bamboo, and start it again. I'm using less biomass. I'm using waste products, sawdust, cardboard, things that I can't use that would otherwise decay or be burned in a landfill. And then take that and then make biochar, which then goes into my garden in the spring. We're also doing carbon farming courses. I'm now calling them climate farming courses. And we've got this model built to where we're doing these courses with other people providing them all over the world, in the Caribbean, in Costa Rica, and other places. My thrust that I try to tell people is what we really want to do is get these so that they're not just one process. You're using that heat, you're using that product, and you're passing it through many stages. In permaculture, we call this multiple yields or stacked yields. So you have water treatment with the charcoal. Then you have a silage conditioner where that same charcoal goes to into the silage to prevent bad toxins and fungus from coming in. And then you have digestive supplements. So it goes into the cows through the silage, and it helps their seven stomachs to digest properly. And then you have a litter amendment. It's going into their manure, which is going into the barn, and then it has going into a manure conditioner, which becomes a soil amendment, which sequesters the carbon. I'll mention cool houses because now I'm getting to the stage where I want to talk about eco-villages. And cool houses are like, okay, straw bale. And we want to replace these subdivisions with which are energy intensive, with buildings that have low embodied energy, cob, earth bags, ways of building with nature using natural materials that do not require a mortgage to build with, that anybody can learn to do with the ground beneath their feet and the things that grow around them. And you can begin to make these climate ready. So you have living roofs. And we can see this in urban settings as well, the use of living roofs to sequester carbon, provide temperature control, and various other good features. So this is Earth Haven Community in North Carolina, earth sheltered and tree sheltered to reduce the need for heating and air conditioning by using natural elements in the landscape. We're actually now experimenting with putting biochar into wall plasters. What does it do? It draws mold spores out of the air and sequesters them in the reef in the wall and actually cleans the air. So it's biobiology. It actually is healthy building syndrome. This is now becoming what we call the eco-village vision. Because I think Pam mentioned the idea of sustainability plus, and this is a big part of what we talk about. It's the quintessentia of eco-village. The earliest eco-village that we know of is Solheimer in Iceland, started in 1930 by a woman named Cecilia Sigmund's daughter. She's now on an Icelandic postage stamp. Cecilia was fortunate enough to buy a farm that had a hot well. It produced hot water at almost 12 gallons per second at almost boiling temperatures. And so with that, she built greenhouses. And today, they are reforesting Iceland from that eco-village, making more than 1 million trees a year, putting back the trees that the Danes and others took away in centuries to make charcoal for European stoves. They're reforesting Iceland with geothermal power. Note the living roofs on all of those buildings. Dominur in Italy is a federation of eco-villages in the Vedraccio Valley in northern Italy. And they're reestablishing the old cultures of cheese and wine and other kinds of good things. Sarvodaya in Sri Lanka, 18,000 eco-villages in their network. They have a self-help pay-it-forward program where one village adopts another and tries to bring that village up to the same living standards as the first village. So wealthy villages have an obligation to adopt poorer ones and bring them up to the same basic standards. You have Japan is probably the newest member of the eco-village network. They have different kinds of cuisine. They're exploring perennial grasses to make udon noodles and things to create new ways of living in Japan. This is quite a challenge given Fukushima. At the farm in Tennessee, we talk about the three-legged stool. So you have to be ecologically sustainable. You have to be sustainable from the standpoint of social dynamics. You have to be able to live with each other in ways that are egalitarian and transparent and so forth. But also, you need to be economically sustainable, something that's often overlooked. So the farm today, another major thing we're doing is sequestering carbon through our footprint. We have grown from an original 750-acre purchase in 1971 to more than 5,000 acres under management today. And most of that is zoned for human exclusion. This is what I see as the future, is carbon-negative villages and settlements around the world, each of them sequestering more than they actually produce. And we're giving workshops now in China with the Global Eco-Village Network and Gaia University to create future designs in China, which provide trainings in how to build villages of this kind. This is our idea, you know, to de-link growth from well-being, to do it immediately and not wait. You have to ask, how do people evolve? How does society change? It changes by example. It changes by carrot, not stick. Sticks always have a reverse blowback effect. Carrots, on the other hand, create permanent change. You look at how others are doing things and you learn and say, I would like to live that way. I would like to do things that way. In Africa, one of our eco-village projects in Senegal is now working with the United Nations and the Global Environmental Facility to plant trees. They're working to set up an international accord across Africa where they're going to plant trees all the way from the Atlantic Ocean to the Indian Ocean and to slowly roll back the Sahara Desert going from south to north. They have an eco-village network in Senegal now that has a ministry for eco-villages in the government and a minister of eco-villages in the government of Senegal with a goal of 18,000 eco-villages by the end of this decade in Senegal to do this tree planting work. So this is our vision. This is how we work. And this is the real wealth. The real question, the only question I have left is, how do we get fast buy-in? How do we get more people to do this quickly? And my sense of it is that we need to make it a viral meme that spreads very infectiously, fungal meme. And so it has to be cool. And so I'm talking about e-cool villages, e-coolnomics, e-cool foods, cool fuels, cool energy systems. If we could get, you know, devices that could go in every home and every backpack, this would be the way to do it, you know? And so, cool living. And if you all come down and visit us at the Eco-Village Training Center at the farm, I'll be happy to show you some of what we're doing. So please join us.
We are totally out of time. Download this program and all our programs as free MP3s at our website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening.